I'm Christopher Lydon with the novelist Ha Jin. He's a Chinese exile and by now a major American writer. His new novel, Nanjing Requiem, is a fresh take on both his countries. It is bathed in sympathy for China's suffering at a low point in the 1930s. But the heroic role in this reality-based fiction goes to an American teacher, Minnie Votren, for her fortitude and her indomitable purpose. We're talking about history that resonates in this 2011 moment. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Welcome back, Ha Jin. You have a book here that can be, seems to me, taken to heart on opposite sides of the earth. And I don't mean to make it sound like a marketing strategy, but this could be the first chance you've had to be published over the counter in China and someday to go home after 25 years on a book tour even. Will you go?
Sure. And in fact, the book was published a month ago in China, and it was well received. It has been very well received. But ironically, I'm not allowed to go to China. My mother has been ill in a hospital, but I wasn't rejected a visa for some technical reason, but I think there are other reasons. But at the moment, I cannot go. The publisher did plan a small tour, in fact.
Someday you'll do it. And I want to be with you. I want to be seeing what you're seeing, looking for what you're looking for. What's the closest you could go to home for you?
You know, because my father was a military officer, so we move around a lot. So the sense of home for me is never a fixed entity. So I really don't know where my hometown was. I really don't know. But I think the longing was always there. But that's the question I've been wrestling constantly. Also, I raise to my students again and again, what is a home? But I think home has deeply involved our personal longing and emotion life. And for me, of course, China is a part of that because I grew up in China. I lived there for 29 years before I came to the States.
Mm.
So there, I could not separate myself from the past.
You said to me once that it would be almost impossible to go to the home of the regime that gave the world Tiananmen Square.
Sure. That was another problem. I still feel uncomfortable. And I hope the government admitted that it was a huge mistake and they should apologize and compensate the victims. And sure, that was a huge problem. And I cannot forgive that.
Mm. It's the year of China at Brown University. It's kind of the decade or the century of China or something, getting to know China. And we're fascinated with this assignment to sort of get our heads, get our arms somehow around this people, and not just the numbers, not just the factory, but somehow the civilization. I'm dying to ask you sort of where do you begin? Where do you begin with your own students in getting to know all the paradoxes of China?
You know, people always assume that China is very different, very remote, even exotic. But China, in fact, in essence, is the same, very similar to the United States. But people are much more poor and suffer more, partly because of the political system. I think among Americans, there has been the fear that China will surpass the United States and become a superpower. That won't happen. I deeply believe in that. For half a century, China will not be in the position to compete with the United States. It's very clear to me.
Won't compete where? They practically own us.
That's the problem. That's the fear. I think part of the reason, the kind of superficial fear. You know, I served in the Chinese army, so I have a military background. As a result, I always look at things more in terms of strength and the military strength and the economic strength. You know, China depends on the United States in most ways. For instance, all the sea routes, you know, China depends on those routes for fuel, for grain, for all the materials needed for the economy. nobody can control that except the United States. But if China controls that, that will take, it'll take a half a century for China to build that kind of navy. And if those routes were shut down for 2 weeks, Chinese economy will collapse. In many ways, this is just one example that the United States have many, many, infinite ways to deal with China. China cannot compete with the United States at all. I think what I fear most is that China has a lot of cash, so they can buy off people. I'm afraid China might buy off the White House. So as a result, the one-party system will stay in place for a long time. That, I think, who will be the victims of that? The Chinese people and also Americans.
Explain that. We've seen people buy the White House, whether it's, you know, the oil industry or the Pentagon or other. How would the Chinese buy it? And then what would they do with it if they could speak to the White House the way the oil industry does, say?
See, they can pay, you know, they have so much money, they can buy off a lot of people. So as a result, the Western countries will be more lenient to their one-party system.
Ah.
So as a result, the Communist Party will stay in power for a long time. Then the regime will remain oppressive to the Chinese people. So I think really the important part is the United States, we should always keep in mind we have our values. And we should help China build a kind of a social infrastructure, democratic infrastructure. In the long run, Chinese people will benefit from it. Also, the United States, Americans will benefit from that because even China becomes powerful eventually, it won't be a hostile state if it has similar kind of social structure. So I think that's the way to go. And really, we shouldn't be afraid of the the Chinese economy and the other kind of superficial appearance, powerful appearance. China is not that strong at all. Look at the neighbors. Every neighbor can be a troublemaker at any moment.
But they own so much of the world. I mean, they have inroads into Africa that we can't begin to match anymore.
But you see, that's our fear. And a relative of mine came to the States. They look at the museums, look at the artworks. They were impressed. Every museum is worth a few cities, Chinese cities. So that depends on how you look at things. And those are really, they just the new money, I would call. Just, you know, people just suddenly have some cash. But in the long run, a country depends on all the resources, all the other kind of wealth, concrete wealth.
Hajin, I'd love you to help us read China through the writers that are becoming more and more available. This blogger, Murong, has become a major celebrity. We got to talk about him.
Yeah.
But Yu Hua is another. Su Tong is another.
Yeah.
There's more and more kind of very outspoken, real-life commentary in fiction and in fact. Maybe start with Murong. I met him in New York a couple of weeks ago, saw you there at the same Asia Society sort of summit, and he's been in the news ever since then, especially with this outburst from Oslo about China called Caging a Monster.
Yes.
And he's going home to China.
He's still in Europe, but I think so far there is no trouble for him.
Yeah. Well, you wonder how he does it, because he says things like this in his Oslo manifesto, Caging a Monster. He says, "My country manufactures powdered milk containing melamine, feeds fish and shrimp contraceptive medications to enhance their growth, uses industrial alcohol to make fake wine, preserves bean curd with human excrement, and produces gutter oil, the product of a notorious practice in which waste oil from gutters outside restaurants is recycled for human consumption." And that's just the beginning. He says, "My country is capable of launching a satellite into space, but not of building a safe bridge across the river. My country is capable of building palatial government offices, yet condemns children to substandard schoolhouses," and on and on. To the world community, he's quoting these views of China. One of them, "Chinese people don't deserve a better life because the quality of the Chinese people is low." He says, "Believe me, people who say this are themselves of low quality." and the line, the Chinese people should not be given too much freedom due to China's unique situation. He says, believe me, people who say this are themselves perpetuating China's unique situation. Or people who say, stability is what China needs the most, not freedom, not human rights. Believe me, people who say this are themselves contributing to instability. This is strong language.
Yeah. I think that language, I think it's well spoken. It's not only the Chinese officials. I think many American officials, U.S. officials, have the same view. We shouldn't really upset the regime. Otherwise, we can't control the situation. We have to deal with what is already there. So that's a very conventional opinion. But I think Murong is right. And that, in a way, I also indirectly address the same issue. If you really care about China, and you should help China and the Chinese people build a basic infrastructure, democratic infrastructure, so that everybody will benefit from it in the long run. And I think that was those were excuses used for prolonging that construction.
I'm halfway through Yu Hua's book on China in 10 words.
Sure, yes.
And absurdity, as in Murong, is right close to the surface of everything he's writing.
Yes, and they, in fact, they touched the same. They wrote about the same kind of issues and problems. In fact, those things Murong raised, poisonous milk and artificial eggs, and they also revealed another aspect of Chinese life. On one hand, there's so much deception, dishonesty. On the other hand, people are still poor.
Mm.
Those won't be consumed by people in power, really rich people. They wouldn't touch those goods at all. So people are still poor. So I think the gaudy facade of the country was just the appearance. At core, it was a still poor country. So many people, especially if we go to the countryside, Peter Hessler's book, right? We look at his book. You can see there were a lot of people. They are still very, very poor.
Yes, we've interviewed Peter Hessler and his wife, Leslie Chang, just recently. And the news from them, as I took it, is this is still no place you'd want to live.
True.
Peter Hester's sort of general observation was that the richer Chinese get, I mean, we're getting into middle-class life, the more neurotic, the more pain, the more difficult the marriage, the unhappier people are.
That's another aspect. See, that's the problem. That's why I think a democratic infrastructure is essential to a country like that, to stabilize the country. People, once they have money now, okay, they have money, but the country, the state can take it away at any moment.
Mm.
As a result, they are fear, they are anxious, they don't think of tomorrow. Or they will try to really to hide money abroad. Or they just want to really squander the money away outside China. So as a result, it's really for the country, I think Peter's right, it's a very difficult place to live. People with means try to get away from the country. So in the long run, China might implode if it doesn't have kind of a social structure that can guarantee some basic safety and human rights.
Back to Murong for a moment. He says, my country takes delight importing the latest jet airplanes and providing aid to foreign countries, despite destitute beggars roaming the land at home, despite many of her people being unable to afford medical care, despite many children being too poor to go to school, and despite a huge number of people living in poverty.
Yes. Yes, I think that's another, in recent, even more than that, just this week, last week, there was a small school bus that had was wrecked on the way, on the country road. The bus had 9 seats, but they put in, they stuffed in 69 children, school kids, and more than 20 of them got killed. Meanwhile, China gave like a few dozens of brand new sturdy school buses to a European country. So people were angry. So that's why what I mean, inside China, a lot of people still, they're poor, life is shabby, but people in power and with money, they don't care anything about that. They want to keep the appearance.
Hajin, I'm wondering, how do you get your news of China? Of course, you have Chinese language, you have the internet, you have friends. A lot of people want to talk to you. But how do you sort out these different kinds of dissident voices, official lines, respect for China, resistance to China? I mean, what's your process of understanding China these days?
You know, there are some kind of associated press, but in the Chinese language outside China. So I read some of those, their size. And they very often they give you kind of more balanced views. And also I follow bloggers. I think that very often that is more intimate. You know, I can see more how people respond. For instance, the bus accident, how people respond to that. No media coverage of that. So, but through the bloggers, I can see a lot of people, they were outraged. They were outraged once they had seen the picture, photograph of the brand new school buses given to a European country.
Mm. Well, Murong is a blogger. He put that sort of diatribe about China on the internet from Oslo. I read that it had 44,000 hits in a matter of minutes, and then the Chinese government took it off the web. I love the way he ended this manifesto from Oslo. He says, "Finally, I hope you believe me that I am not a class enemy, not an overthrower of governments. All I want is to cage the monster. Yes, I am criticizing my country, but that doesn't mean I hate my country. Rather, I love my country. I love her splendid mountains and rivers and her great civilization. I appreciate the suffering she has experienced. In fact, I love my country even more because of the suffering she has been through. Yes, I am criticizing her rotten system, but I do not want to see bloodshed while my country is improving herself. I hope the system will improve gracefully. I hope in the near future, in my country, flowers of freedom will blossom and children will smile without fear. I hope in the near future, my country, an ancient civilization, a land of suffering, will become a nation of prosperity, peace, and freedom for all."
See, I think the guy is very smart. You know, he knows where to cross the line, because for a lot of Chinese, the idea of the country is still sacred. You cannot say anything against the country, but the metaphor itself, caged animal. Who is the animal? It's the country, right? You create the country, but you are fearful of the country. That's why you want to contain the country. That's logical. Any political system should be contained that way. But he wouldn't say that. Mm. But for me, I gave an interview in the article, and of course the article was cut many places, but the idea came out kind of rather obscurely. But my metaphor was a country is a house, it's not a temple. So the house can be repaired and even overhauled, but it's supposed to be a safe shelter for people. It's not a temple. That's why I wouldn't take a country to be a sacred object. But this guy, he knows he cannot cross that line. Because if he crossed that line, he would be in trouble. To many Chinese, that is not acceptable. But I think we have to be more objective. A country is not sacred. It's no more than a mansion. It's not a temple.
We've got to talk about your book, Nanjing Requiem, which I found completely fascinating. And it crosses new lines for you in the perspective on both of these places, China of your growing up, America of your career today. There's cruelty, there's killing, there's huge sadness in this book, and suffering. There's still, even more remarkable, it seems to me, compassion for a whole swath of characters, Germans, Brits, Americans, and of course the Chinese, all of them engulfed in this Japanese invasion and humiliation of China in 1937, remembered for the genocidal slaughter, the rape of Nanking or Nanjing, in which several hundred thousand Chinese civilians died on the way to the slaughterhouse of World War II. And you've brought it all back. You see it through the pinhole of one college campus in Nanjing. It meant to be the Wellesley College of China.
Yes.
It becomes a sort of halfway refuge for women and children during the Japanese occupation, a miniature of the big horror show. And there in the middle, this woman, Minnie Vautrin, continues with zeal and decency against the barbarism mm-hmm. all around her. She doesn't prevail, but her fortitude and her practical sense are not compromised by the war either. And they're certainly not embarrassed by it.
No. I think I try to describe the mental suffering. So the first part or quarter of the book is about the violent period. But the other parts basically are given to the description or a portrait of people's mental suffering. In fact, also including spiritual crisis. And Minnie Walton, she was a Christian and a profoundly believer in the church, but eventually she couldn't continue anymore and took her own life. So in that sense, she is a victim. She was a victim of the war, the violence. On the other hand, she was a hero. And to many Chinese, local Chinese, after the massacre, she was a hero. I remember as a goddess of mercy. But then when the communists came to power, they suppressed that page. And nobody knew about her. All the Americans' involvement in the tragedy. And that was a blank page until recently. Until Iris Chang's book, The Rape of Nanjing, was published in the late 90s. So I want to bring back that back because really the massacre, the tragedy, was not the only Chinese experience. It was also part American and international experience.
Mm.
For instance, at the Tokyo war criminal trial, the Chinese couldn't come up with any evidence because when they were fighting, they had not imagined that they would become victors to try these criminals.
Mm.
So really, the trial, the judges depend on the evidence collected by American missionaries, graphics, reading materials, and to decide on the case. So in that part, in many aspects, in fact, the more we think about it, the more clear it is about the American involvement in this tragedy.
Mm. How should we read that in 2011 in this kind of still evolving rapidly connection between America and China?
Yeah, I think people very often assume there's a kind of hostility between the country. In fact, that's not true. Only after the few decades after the communists came to power. So that was the Korean confrontation. And so the later hostility. Mm-hmm. But that was developed just in a few decades. But before that, there had been long time and very decent relationship between the two countries and two peoples. And that was interrupted. But at least this book showed that there are values, basic human decency, that really can transcend national interests and political biases.
Mm.
I think that should be remembered. In that sense, even today, when we talk about another country, we should remember people are human beings. Their sufferings are same as ours.
The purpose of that Japanese occupation seems to have been designed to make the Chinese feel helpless, incompetent, unmanly. I wonder, what are you saying to China about the scar of that memory today?
When I grew up, I heard of it, but I knew nothing about the details at all. And so the memory was blurred. And a lot of people are reluctant to remember because this was a painful page. And the Chinese government, at some point, they discouraged. And as a result, this part was never clear.
Mm.
And there are always, I think, people's interpretations or even literature on this topic had been interfered or compromised by political needs. So as a result, it was very hard to do anything thorough or literary. In fact, there have not been many pieces of literature written on this. When I started this book, I hadn't read any, basically. So that
and yet everybody knows, I mean, even I knew that the Rape of Nanking, the Japanese in China in the 30s was a total horror show.
But see, that's why when I grew up, I just vaguely heard of it, but I didn't know anything
really?
In detail. I didn't know anything in detail. But when I came out, you see, the irony was the Chinese Americans here, they would hold gathering meetings in memory of this tragedy every year. So that's how I first encountered the kind of the horror, because there would be exhibits of graphics and other materials. And I was shocked. That was an eye-opener. So the people outside China, in fact, had kept the memory alive.
In the novel, Minnie Votrin is described as resenting the Chinese fashion of forgetfulness. It's interesting. Leslie Chang, Wall Street Journal reporter in China just recently, has said the same thing to us, that China has a problem with its past, with its memory.
I know, yes. And in fact, the officials try to suppress and even distort memories.
And she's troubled even by why the Chinese submitted to the Cultural Revolution, why it took it so long, not to mention Nanjing. But Minnie Votrin says history should be recorded as it happened so it can be remembered with little room for doubt and controversy. That's out of your book. I presume you sort of made up the line out of her imagination. But what's she driving at, and what are you driving at?
You know, I think in the West, whenever a major event happened, we must really preserve all the material, the evidence, and to keep the memory alive and for future generations to reflect on or to study. But in China, I think what happened, but basically any major event, once happened, the government would control all the archival work. And they also made rules, immediately set up rules for the media. So as a result, a lot of people are not exposed to any information, had no access to any information at all.
What's the cure for this resistance to memory, this kind of turning away?
I think, you know, we cannot make everybody remember, but as a writer or an artist, I think that's our duty, to not only to remember historical events, but to transcend history, to make a piece of art after it. So as a result, that memory can be preserved intact in the arts.
You've spoken of making a pair of shoes out of memory, making them work, making it fit, and then moving forward.
Sure, I think that's my ambition. Really, through time and go beyond time. Really, but we have to start somewhere, a concrete historical moment.
Describe what you're doing with memory. Just what is it you want to give us and China?
I think I want to remind people both sides, the Chinese and the Americans, that there are moments when two peoples came together. They did some heroic work. They suffered together. And not because they are different in languages and culture, but they are same as human beings.
Could that spirit grab hold, do you think, in the next 50 years, 30 years?
I think it's possible. I think it's still possible. I think that's why we should really make effort, devoted effort, to have the Chinese build a structure that is suitable, a democratic system that is suitable to the Chinese people and their situation. And in the long run, I think most Chinese would be grateful for that. And we will benefit from it.
It requires a democratic conversion, you sense.
Yes, absolutely. And even, I think the truth is, even the Chinese top leaders, they believe in that as well. But because many of them, they had gotten so much wealth, ill-gotten wealth, and they cannot give that up. So that's why they try to hold on to power. But everybody knows the country, the system would have to change. Otherwise, the country would implode. But democracy will have to prevail. I think our responsibility is to help that process, to shorten the process and let the real democracy come to China sooner.
We have to include the poet Liu Xiaobo in this conversation. He won the Nobel Prize last year, and he'll be out in print everywhere soon with these June 4th elegies for the protesters, his fellow protesters in Tiananmen Square in the spring of 22 years ago. He's written poems every year in memory of June 4th.
Yes.
This was 2005. He writes, 16 years later, the night's white lily of sacrifice has transformed into nightmare, a wound like an ideal torn apart, stutter stammering through the story of the graves. 16 years ago in that moment, the world was a lamb, allowing the madness of slaughter, turning to heaven, speechless, stupefied, weeping in silence, sighing in silence. I no longer hear the sky echoing slogans and promises anymore, like noise to a deaf mute. Can't hear the screaming bullets, can't feel the fear of approaching tanks. I no longer recognize those infant faces anymore, hungry and thirsty souls of the dead rush to mother's breasts, yet cannot suck one drop of milk. I no longer recognize time anymore. I can't distinguish day from night, trapped in 10,000 years of history, a falling star unable to find its own grave. Even the publication of those very powerful poems betokens some deep curiosity of the world mm-hmm. about something below the surface of China's
yes.
story.
Yes, for instance, the tragedy, we all saw it, and even the communists, they know that was a terrible crime or mistake on their part. But they would not apologize. They would not take responsibility for it. And so that showed how the regime functions. In the long run, this cannot continue because it does not have the justification for this kind of the way of governing a country. And so that's why it's necessary to have a multi-party system. And there are many cases like that, not just the June 4th. There are other political campaigns, disasters, but no apologies at all from the party.
Liu Xiaobo is, in effect, under house arrest now and
yes.
forever, maybe.
Yeah.
What does that story portend?
It shows the stupidity on the ruling party, on the ruling party's part, and that also shows how fragile and fearful they are. They are afraid of just one person who would speak openly. So I think that's why we shouldn't take China as very strong opponent at all. It has infinite problems inside and outside. Mm. It is very, very fragile.
It is wonderful, Haijin, to talk with you again, and I'm so grateful for your faithful writing and your generous conversation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I'm very happy to be here.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.